Baruchim Abayim, ladies. We begin to study Parashat Vayeshev Yaakov. Literally, it means, and Yaakov settled. Vayeshev Yaakov. Rashi says, explaining this, Bikesh Yaakov Yishev B'Shalva. Yaakov requested to sit in tranquility. Kafatz alav rugzo shel Yosef. He wanted to relax a little. Rightfully so. He just went through 22 years of Lavan. He just went through the whole ordeal with the angel of Esav. And then the whole ordeal with Esav himself. Yaakov has a right to want a vacation. Yaakov has a right to say, God, I want to relax a little. God says, you want to relax? Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Lo dayan latzadikim ma shemetukanem le'olam haba. It's not enough the relaxation that the tzadikim are going to get in olam haba. Ela shemevakshim lishem b'shalva be'olam hazeh. They also want to relax in this world? No. So what does God do? Immediately when he sees Yaakov want to let down a little, Yosef, his son is now missing. He thinks he's dead. Now he has to go through another, how many years, 22 years of suffering about his son. Rabbi Gifter says an amazing, amazing concept. He says, and what's so bad with tranquility in life? And what's so wrong with tranquility and peace of mind and serenity? Is it so bad? It's a good thing. Harambam writes that all the blessings that God promises us, if we keep the Torah, all the blessings in this world, you'll have money, you'll have health, you'll have success. He asks an obvious question. Can you put a price on observance of mitzvot? You're going to tell me if I put on tefillin, I got a lot of money. Is that a fair equivalence? There's no price you could put on any mitzvah. So what is the Torah guaranteeing us all these blessings? He says, you're right. The reward for mitzvot is an olam haba. You can never get paid for any mitzvah in this world. But when God sees you doing the mitzvot, he'll give you money. So now you'll have peace of mind. Well, you don't have to worry about paying your bills. And what are you going to buy? And what are you going to eat? So you can do more mitzvot. He'll give you health. Because when your health is intact, you're able to do more mitzvot. It's not that that's the reward for the mitzvah. The reward for the mitzvah is going to be tranquility. Why? In order now you can do more mitzvot. So you see, according to Harambam, that's the greatest blessing in the world. Give me peace of mind so I can sit down and learn Gemara without any distractions. But if I have to sit in the Gemara worrying about my family problem and a personal problem and another issue, I can't concentrate. So poor Yaakov, all he wants is some tranquility. And God says, oh, tranquility, now we're going to get you with Yosef. Now your problems are going to be good. So Rabbi Gifter says the following. He says, life is full of situations. For your own good. Every situation that you find yourself in is not by chance or by mistake or by coincidence. Every situation in life that you find yourself in right now in the present was tailor-made for you by God, because he wants you to be in that situation, because he believes you can achieve spiritual perfection by being in that situation. Therefore, you should never ask to change your situation, because that situation was made for you in order to achieve something, in order that your soul will perfect something. Maybe when somebody is sick, God is perfecting his soul because he wants him to do a mitzvah under duress. Maybe that spiritual accomplishment must be realized. And therefore, certainly one would rather not be sick. Certainly one does not want to go through pressures. But Rabbi Gifter says, if that's what he has, you must take advantage of it. So when Sadiqeen ask for a different situation, God says, what do you mean? Like the Hafez Chaim, somebody once came to him. The Hafez Chaim asked him, how's life? So the fellow said, it could be better. So he said, who said it could be better? I said it could be better. He says, if it could be better, then it would be better. Meaning if God wanted it to be better, it would be better. Obviously, by being better, in your mind, is not better because it's not happening. And therefore, whatever's happening to you is the best situation. Therefore, you should never ask to trade because it's what's necessary for you. Therefore, Yaakov says, okay, now I want to relax. Not now. There's a few more tests that you must go through. Torah tells us, Ele Toledot Yaakov, these are the children of Yaakov, Yosef. Strange. These are the children of Yaakov. He had 12 children. But the Torah only tells us one of them, Yosef. Rashi tells us, because there was a lot of similarities between Yaakov and Yosef. They had similar lifestyles, similar occurrences that took place to Yaakov, took place to Yosef. Rashi says, Kol ma she'ira li Yaakov, ira li Yosef. Zenistam, v'zenistam. They were both hated. Yosef was hated by the brothers, and Yaakov was hated by his brother, Esav. Ze achiv mevakesh lehorgo, v'ze achiv mevakshim lehorgo. Both wanted to be, or both were victims of a potential murder. Esav wanted to kill Yaakov, the brothers wanted to kill Yosef. So I saw an explanation. They come along and say, listen, even though this is one of the most difficult stories to understand, the brothers hating Yosef. They were jealous, they hated him. We're not talking about simple people. I want you to remember that. Even though the Torah says they were jealous, it has nothing to do with the jealousy that you and I know. Even though it says they hated him, it has nothing to do with the hate that me and you know. The Shevatim were pure. The name of God is attached to their name, Shivteya. God endorses them as holy people. But it says they hated. It says they were jealous. That means there was a trace of jealousy in the recesses of their heart that only God, with his X-ray vision, was able to pick it up. I was able to see it. If we were there watching it, you wouldn't see any hatred. You would see 10 rabbis sitting in a court of Jewish law with the beards and the hats and the books, judging if Yosef is innocent or guilty according to Torah law, not according to emotion. This was nothing to do with emotion. I know you didn't never learned it this way. I know most of you read it. Acrimony. Brothers always fight. You remember your kids, they were brothers, the kids, the boys, your children, they're beating each other up. So it happened to Yosef and his brothers also. It happens to men in business all day long. Brothers can't get along. So you say, it's an old story. Didn't start in my family. It started all the way back in the times of Yosef and the brothers. There's jealousy. Why did he get a ketonet pasim? I didn't get one. It's not fair. Erase all those images. Erase all those sentiments. That is not the story. There is no semblance of that in the story. So what is Rashi doing? Rashi comes along and says, a lot of similarities between Yaakov and Yosef. Yaakov's brother Esav hated him. And Yosef, his brothers hated him. Come on, Rashi. There's a big difference between the hatred that Esav had for Yaakov. That's the real hatred. That's the real unadulterated hatred. I mean, Esav wanted blood. So you're comparing? Oh yeah, same story. He was hated by Esav, and he was hated by his brothers. Wait, the hate of the brothers has nothing to do with the hate of Esav. That's not even a connection. So what is Rashi comparing? So let's do a deep explanation. The comparison over here is the side effects of this hatred. What does it mean? As a result of the hatred that Esav had for his brother, Yaakov was forced to run away. He ended up living in Laban's house for 22 years. All this is a side effect. The hatred caused him to become a fugitive. He had to run away. He lived in Laban's house for 22 years. Amazingly enough, was Yaakov affected in the house of Laban? Nothing. A miracle. He lives 22 years with a Shylock, with a crook, with a gangster, with the most assimilated man. Goy, Obed, Abu Dazara, everything. And Yaakov's living there 22 years. Usually, as a rule, bad influences good before good influences bad. The powers of evil are always much stronger than the powers of good. So the odds are against Yaakov. Miraculously, he's able to control himself. He's able to insulate himself. You know what that did for us? Did us a big favor. Because get this rule good. Whatever trait our forefathers mastered, it created a gene. That gene is transmitted in their descendants. Understand that? When we say we're the children of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, that means we have their same DNA. We have their makeup. Yaakov at that moment created a gene of insulation, of protection from outside influences. It's a great accomplishment. It was one of the good effects that came out from the hatred of Esav. Because Esav hated him, he pushed him out, forced him to live by Laban. As a result of that, he was able to insulate himself. Until today, Jews are able to remain Jews, Orthodox Jews, as we are, even though we're living in such a perverse society. Can't imagine it. How'd we make it? How are we still here today? There shouldn't be any Jews around in the world. We're a minute of a percentage of a percent of the population. Certainly, the environment in America should overtake us. Where did we get that strength to remain steadfast against those influences? From Yaakov. So a side effect from the influence of the side effect from the hatred of Esav was the gene that was created by Yaakov in the house of Laban. Same thing with the brothers. The brothers' hatred caused a positive side effect to Yosef and to us. As a result of their hatred, where did Yosef end up? King of Egypt. Viceroy of Egypt. Vice king of Egypt. He became an ultimate leader. He managed the whole land. He saved everybody from famine. You know where that leadership is going to come out one day? He created a gene of leadership. From the tribe of Yosef is going to come the Mashiach. There's two Mashiachs. One Mashiach is Ben David, and one Mashiach is Ben Yosef. Where is Mashiach Ben Yosef, who is going to come first, by the way? First Mashiach ben Yosef comes, then Mashiach ben David comes. Where is Mashiach ben Yosef going to receive the strength to manage Am Yisrael? You need to be a certain personality. You know where that strength was created? When Yosef became the manager of Egypt. So just like there was a positive effect from the hatred that Esav had to Yaakov, there was a positive effect of the hatred that the brothers had to Yosef. Not that the hatreds were equal. The hatreds were different night and day. But the result from the hatred is similar. Both produced positive genes that eventually would help and affect Am Yisrael in the future. Torah tells us, V'Yisrael ahavet Yosef mikol banav. Yaakov loved Yosef. Why did he love Yosef? From all his children. He was a favorite child. Why? Ki ben zekunim hu lo. What does it mean, ben zekunim? Very good. The baby of the family. So one rabbi asked, and you usually see that. The little child that the parents have in their old age. And when they're a little older, they get spoiled. They love them more. So that's the same thing over here. Ben zekunim. But the Hezkuni asks a very strong question. Yosef wasn't the youngest. Binyamin was the youngest. I mean, so if you're telling me over here, Ben Zikuni means because he had him in his old age, the love should really be to Binyamin. He gives an answer, and his answer is really, it's cryptic. It's hard to understand what he meant. He says like this, you know why he didn't love Binyamin as much? Because Rachel died when she was giving birth to Binyamin. So there's two ways of understanding this. Either you can explain it that whenever he saw Binyamin, it brought back bad memories to him, that that's the way his wife died. And therefore, the love wasn't the same. But it's hard to say that about Yaakov Abinu. Yaakov Abinu doesn't hold that against his son because of what happened. He understands that if that happened to Rachel, that's meant from God. But the explanation they give is, in marriage, there's a father and there's a mother. And the fruit of this union, of marriage, of this partnership, is the child. True love of a child can only be had when there's a mother and there's a father. If there's no mother and father, then it is impossible for one to love the child even the same. He can't compensate for the love of his mother. When it's a unit, that love is constantly reinforced. The mother's love over the father's love, the father to the mother, it's constantly re-energized. Therefore, Yaakov was at a loss. Of course he loved Binyamin, but he couldn't love Binyamin because there was no mother. And therefore, automatically the love was compromised. Nothing he can do. It's out of his control. When there's no mother, when there's no partnership, automatically the love must dwindle and must wane. It's very scary. As the Gemara says, that means not in a divorce. The Gemara says, if there's a divorce, it says, even the Mizbeach cries. Even the altar in the temple cries at a time of divorce. So Rav Pam, Alav HaShalom, said, what does this mean? The Mizbeach cries. The Mizbeach is made out of stones, rocks. What is the Gemara trying to tell us? So he says, unbelievable. He says, what do they do on the Mizbeach every day? On the Mizbeach, they brought sacrifices. So Rav Pam says, you have to know, in a divorce, there's going to be major sacrifices, major korbanot. But not of sheep, and not of lambs. The sacrifices in a divorce are the children. That's the korban. That's the sacrifice. Ultimately, it's those children that lose out. The parents move on, they remarry, they go, they do. What's going to be with the children? So that's what says the Mizbeach cries, because the Mizbeach knows what it means, Korbanot. The Mizbeach has sacrifices on it all day long. The Mizbeach understands what it means that there's going to be great loss. Torah tells us further that the jealousy and the sin'ah starts to escalate. The brothers finally decide that they have to do something with Yosef. So the first conclusion they come out is they're going to throw him into a pit and kill him. They'll kill him. They'll hide the evidence. And we'll tell our father that a wild animal ate him up. We'll take his coat. We'll dip it in some blood. We'll tell father, what are you going to do? We found it. Reuven comes along. The oldest son. Vayishmar Reuven. Vayatzirehu miyadam. He says, no, Rabotai, I'm the firstborn. I'm responsible. I will not let this happen. Lo nakenu nafesh. We can't kill him. Nu Reuven. So what's your idea? So what do you want to do with Yosef? He says, let's just leave him in the pit, and we won't touch him. We'll put it in God's hands, so to speak. Leave him in the pit. What was Reuven's intent? Drop him in the pit. Everybody will go home. Reuven will come back and pull him out. There's an amazing midrash on this story with Reuven. As the Torah actually says, Reuven was trying to save his brother. It was a good thing he did. So the midrash says, if Reuven would have known that this episode would have been written in the Torah, that he actually tried to save his brother, if he would have known it would have been written, he would have taken Yosef on his shoulders and carry him home. And the Midrash continues. The Midrash says, when Moshe was coming to redeem the people out of Egypt, it says Aaron, his brother, went to greet him. And Aaron was very happy for him, and he smiled, and he hugged him. So the Midrash says, if Aaron would have known that that hug and that smile that he had for his younger brother's success was going to be written in the Torah, he would have went out in a parade of music and dancing. And if Boaz was a great tzaddik, there was a convert lady, Ruth, in his field. One day, Boaz threw her some barley to eat. He did a favor to a convert. Gave it to eat barley. The Midrash says, if Boaz would have known that that chesed would have been documented in the Torah, he wouldn't have given a barley. He would have given a fattened calves. He would have given a 7-course meal. How are we to understand this, Midrash? Well, you think Reuven was looking for kavod? If he knew his name was going to be in the newspaper, then he would have done it with all the embellishments. What does that mean? Reuven cares about the honor and the glory? What does he mean? Boaz, if he would have known the reporters were watching him give that grain, he would have done it with a little more gusto. How do you explain this? The explanation is as follows. Reuven, at the time he was saving his brother, he wasn't able to do it with full heart because he had 9 skeptics questioning what he was doing. So he wasn't sure. He thought he was right by saving his brother, but you have 9 people saying, I don't know what you're doing, I don't know why you want to save him, we want to kill him. But had he known, Reuven, that the Torah endorsed him, had he would have known from the beginning that he was 100% right and the Torah is going to glorify him, that he was the right one, then he would have done it with full gusto. Aharon hugged Moshe. He was happy for him. But he didn't know if Moshe was going to be accepted or not. He didn't know the people who were going to take it. After all, Aharon's older. Maybe the Jews are going to say, it's not fair, we don't want Moshe, we never saw him, you were with us all these years. Aharon was questionable if what's going to be the reaction. Therefore, if Aharon would have known that this is exactly what's supposed to happen and he did the right thing, he might have made a parade. But he couldn't have made a parade because he was doubting it because of all the skeptics. Boaz, when he gave the food to Ruth, he knew she was a tzaddiket. But what do you think the people around Boaz were doing? Started making faces. Hey, what's going on between Boaz and Ruth? He's giving this lady a food over. It must be there's something going on. Boaz, an old man, he's giving food to an old little young lady. What's the kind of business this over here? If Boaz would have known and wouldn't have been scared of the reaction of the people, he would have done it. Meaning if he would have known the endorsement of the Torah, that the Torah says Boaz was right for going after Ruth, and he didn't have to worry about what people are going to say, He would have done it with a 7-course meal. But it's always the skeptics, it's always the people that cause us to not fulfill the mitzvot the way we're supposed to. If we were on an island, we'd do mitzvot the most mahmir way, we'd be modest, we wouldn't eat things, we wouldn't go to places. Most of the time, why we end up compromising is because we're worried what people are going to say. But if we would know that God is telling you, you have my endorsement, you're right, don't listen to them. They don't know. You know. If you knew that you had the endorsement of God, you're not scared of anybody. So when all my friends that tell me, come eat out in the restaurant, so you're questioning. There's pressure. But if you know that Borei Olam says, written in the Torah, you know you're the right one, so then you can do it with full gusto. You should never let the peer pressure of society, who unfortunately, in many cases are wrong, bring you down. Reuven got a little watered down by the brothers. Nah, what are you doing? If you would have known that God told him, you're the right one, do it like you want to do it, then he would have done it like he wanted to do it. Aaron, he would have made a parade, but public reaction. Ruth, Boaz, he would have done it 7-course meal, but what are people going to say? Don't be scared of people. Don't be afraid of people. You only have to impress one person. You only impress God. One that impresses God has one boss. One that impresses people has a million bosses. He's a slave to every single person in the street. He's a slave to every person's idea and every person's opinion. Certainly he can never be consistent. One day he has to agree with this one, another day he has to agree with this one. He's scattered. He has no life. But the servant of God, he is a king. Because he does not have to serve any other man. So that continues. It says they threw him in a pit. The pit was empty. V'haborek and bomayim. It's a little redundant. The pit was empty. There was no water. So that she says, there was no water, but there were snakes and scorpions. We can learn a great lesson from this. One rabbi said, a bore is a cavity. A bore can be explained as the cavity of the mind. The human mind is in a cavity. The haborek, when the mind is empty, en bomayim, it does not have water, which represents Torah. When the mind is devoid of study of Torah, don't think the mind is a vacuum. Don't think, there's no Torah, there's nothing. No. Nehashim v'akrabim yeshbo. Automatically, all the vices and all the snakes and scorpions enter. You cannot have pav. There's no such thing as pav. There's no such thing as, well, I don't study Torah, but I'm good. Impossible. En bomayim, without study of Torah, nehashim v'akrabim must set in. In the summer, crime goes up. Always. Why? Because children are not occupied. They're not in school. They have time on their hands. They come into trouble. They start to vandalize cars. They start to steal. When they're in school, they're occupied. When the mind is not occupied, automatically it'll lead to destruction. V'haborek embo mayim. Mayim embo. Nehashim v'akrabim yeshbo. They come back to Yaakov. They tell him, listen, this is what happened. He rips his garments, he puts on sackcloth, and he mourns his son for an indefinite time. Pasuk writes, Vayakumu kol banav v'chol benotav l'nechamo. All his sons and his daughters He had 11 sons left. Each one was born with a twin. So he has 11 girls. They went to console him. They see their father sitting. He's upset. He's crying. They went to console him. He refused to be consoled. So one of the rabbis say, it doesn't say what they told him. So they got up, the sons and the daughters, to console him, but he refused to be consoled. What did they say? So one rabbi says they didn't say anything. The biggest consolation to a person that Bar Minan loses a child is that he has other children. So they were trying to signal to Yaakov, you lost one. So they just went and stood. They made a plan. All the boys, all the girls, the grandchildren, they all stood in front of Yaakov. They just stood there. Let him see what he has left. They were trying to signal to him, Yaakov, you're not bankrupt. Baruch Hashem, you have great family. But even with that, he refused. Our rabbis learned a lesson from it. One of the greatest gifts that God gave man is the ability to forget. Sometimes we wish we weren't overly blessed with such a blessing of forgetfulness, but it's a blessing. Think about it. If you would never forget, you'd never get over anything. You'd be walking in the street 30 years later. I remember what he did to me in second grade when I was in the class. He took my desk. And it would bother you with the same intensity as it did on the day it happened. But what happens? On the day it happens, you say, I'll never forgive him. And then a week later, it becomes a little less bothersome. And then a month later, and then a year later, you say, what are you talking about? I forgot about it. Don't even remind me. I don't know what you're talking about. So to forget is a great thing. It cleanses you. It relieves you from a lot of old issues and problems. Time heals all wounds, as they say. In death, it's the same thing. Bar Minan, on the day of the funeral, the family says, I'll never eat again, I'll never dance again, I'll never sing again, I'll never marry again, I'll never see another day of happiness. And they really believe it. There's no way they can conceive how they're going to move on. 30 days pass, it becomes a little easier for them. A year passes, already they find themselves at parties again, they find themselves laughing again, socializing, maybe a year and a half, 2 years, already it's over. They move on. Things that they never dreamt they'd be able to do, now they're able to. Why? Because God gave a gift, and it's a gift, that after somebody dies, you will forget. Not forget them, but forget the pain in order that you can move on. But watch. This gift is only given that you'll forget and the pain will subside is if the person is dead. But if the person didn't die, that gift is never activated. Yosef was alive. So therefore Yaakov Avinu was actually mourning a live person. Therefore, he never forgot. Therefore, he never got over it. For 22 years, he's sitting on the floor crying. Said, what about God's gift of forgetting? He's not dead. They ask a question here. Yaakov should have known from that, that he's not dead. I'll leave that. It's a big answer to this question. But I learned a great lesson from this. His refusal to be consoled is an indication of life. The Gemara says that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed about 2,000 years ago. Why are we still mourning? Get over it. 1 year, 2 years. When did you ever mourn something for 2,000 years? How come we still cry on Tisha B'Av, and how come we still have dozens of ceremonies to commemorate the Beit HaMikdash? Wouldn't you consider this over-exaggerated mourning? And the explanation is, that's the biggest consolation. The biggest consolation to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash is that we're still mourning it. Because that's an indication that it's still alive. That's an indication that it's still here and there's a Beit HaMikdash and it's coming back. Because if we would have forgotten it after 1 year, that means it's over. That means it's dead. It's past. It's finished. So the biggest consolation, the Gemara says, Kol ha-mit-abel al Yerushalayim, those that mourn Jerusalem, Zocheh ve-ro'eh b'simchata, they merit in the present. Merit in the present, it's happiness. Merit in the future. Not merit in the present. Yes. Those that mourn Yerushalayim have a merit in the now. Because their mourning indicates that Yerushalayim is still alive. And the temple is still there. It just has to be brought down by Borei Olam. Further into the parasha, Torah tells us of a relation, thank you, a relation between Yehuda and Tamar, a most complicated subject. Basically what happened was like this. Yehuda is married to a lady. They have two children. At first, two boys, Er and Onan. Er and Onan marry. Er and Onan die. Yehuda has his daughter-in-law that's left a widow. The lady's name is Tamar. It's the daughter-in-law of Yehuda. She was married to two of his sons. They both died. One day, Tamar is standing on the road. She covers herself up. Yehuda does not recognize who she is. Yehuda goes into the tent with Tamar. She comes out of the tent, and she's pregnant. Who is she pregnant from? A father-in-law. Father-in-law. Yehuda. Scandal of scandals. Everybody knows she's not married. Now all of a sudden, she's pregnant. She must have went with somebody. Betin! Who sits on the Betin? Yehuda. He's the Supreme Court judge. She comes in front of him. What kind of business? You're pregnant. You're the daughter of a Kohen. Yehuda rules. Guilty. Punishable by Sirifa. Burn her. She gives a signal to Yehuda that from the one that gave me these collaterals, because she asked for something before she was with him, she had his stick. To the one that owns this stick, she said it in a hint way, that's the one that I became pregnant from. Yehuda realizes it's him. Yehuda says, okay, tzadikah, she's right. Mimeni. See a lot of great character over here. Tremendous character. You see the character of Tamar. Tamar wouldn't open her mouth. She could have came in the court and started screaming. What are you going to kill me now? They're ready to take her out to burn. The bailiff came in, they're grabbing her, they're going to take her out to burn. Scream, what do you mean? You're going to tell me? You're going to burn me? It was you! She didn't want to embarrass Yehuda. She said, I'd rather burn than embarrass Yehuda. So she hinted, nobody knows, to the one that the stick belongs to, that's what I'm praying. No one knows if it's Yehuda's stick or somebody else. It's a signal. Look at what it means not to embarrass somebody. From here the Gemara says you should be willing to jump into a burning furnace and not to embarrass your friend. That's what she was willing to do. And she knew, mind you, because you'll see now, she knew that if she's with Yehuda, which had to be, and I'll show you that it was permissible, from that relationship Mashiach came. They had a child called Peretz from that relation. From Peretz came David HaMelech. David HaMelech is Mashiach. So from that relation, that started the light of Mashiach. So she knew what she was doing. She knew the importance of the subject. But she said, if bringing the Mashiach entails embarrassing somebody in public, I'm out. Let God bring it another way. Look what she was willing to give up. Not only her life, which is obviously the most important, but her fame. Instead of going down to be the mother of the Mashiach, she's willing to destroy all that in order not to embarrass. Look at the trait of Yehuda. From Yehuda, I learn honesty. I mean, he could have covered it up. It's embarrassing. He has to explain himself now. What were you doing sleeping with your daughter-in-law? He could have said, I don't know, I never saw the stick. I don't know. I don't know who it is. All right, take her away, kill her. I don't know. Would anybody say anything? Nobody would know. For Yehuda to get up in front of all the people and say, it's from me. What an honesty. You're not embarrassed. You admit a tremendous trait. The only question is, how is it legitimate? It's legitimate because of one Torah law. And you have to know they kept the Torah before it was given. The Torah says, a lady's married to a man, the man dies. If there's a brother, he must marry the girl in fulfilling the mitzvah of Yibum. You heard of the mitzvah of Yibum? It's Torah law. In the olden days, Jewish custom was that not only the brother would fulfill the mitzvah of Yibum, but the closest family relative. So technically, Yehuda is a relative to Tamar, who was married to one of his sons. His son died, so technically he falls into Yibum. So halachically, there was no problems over here of any impropriety. My last question is, and we'll finish with this, from such a relationship, Mashiach comes? It's mutar, but it smells a little. I mean, he doesn't know who he's with until after. I mean, he thinks it's a stranger at the time, and then... And you read the story, it sounds very strange until you get the interpretation that you have to find in a commentary on the bottom of the book in small letters. Oh, this is Yibum, so it's kosher. Yeah, but until that, you look and you say, well, God, if you're bringing Mashiach, which is the ultimate man, the ultimate redeemer, he should, you know, it should say there was a big tzaddik. He went to the mikveh. His wife went to the mikveh. They prayed for 3 days. They made fasting. And then they were together and they brought Mashiach. Oh, there's a story. But to bring it like this, the Zohar says, listen to a Zohar. I'm allowed to tell this to you. It's easy. The Zohar says precisely that. Precisely that. When you're bringing in diamonds and trying to smuggle them through customs, do you bring them in a beautiful box? So the custom agent right away says, oh, open the box. Or maybe you smuggle them under hay and under some rubbish and garbage. So when the custom agent looks and says, oh, what is this? Go, go, go right to this one. The Satan is always on guard. The powers of evil, the Yetzirah, that whole family, they're always trying to destroy any good that comes in the world. God created him and he does his job loyally. That's what he's there to do when he does it. So God has to bring Mashiach, this timing in the world. But he has to pass through customs that the Satan and the Yetzer Hara won't even realize that it's happening. So he doesn't come and undo it. So if you look throughout history, all the relationships that Mashiach was part of were all funny. Lot was with his daughters. Remember Lot and his two daughters, they were in the cave together. They thought they were the only people left in the world. I mean, it's incest. He didn't know. At the time, he thought they were the only people left in the world. And they said, if we don't have children, then there's not going to be any more world. From that ancestral relationship came a tribe, came a nation called Moab. From Moab came Ruth. Ruth is the grandmother of David HaMelech. You have Yehuda and Tamar. You have Boaz and Ruth, which was also a controversial marriage. David and Bathsheba. Always when you look at the family of the Mashiach, you go down the line, you say, wow, this is a strange one. This is all permissible. They were all kosher, by the way. But they had a smell to that. This is funny. The explanation is why? In order to bypass the Satan. So therefore you learn a lot of times some of the best things take place under circumstances where you say, it's not coming from here. That's what you have to be careful. That's good. The Satan is decoyed. The Satan now is somewhere else. And therefore, because that's the depth of the explanation of the story of Yehuda and Tamar. Amen.